fix up old buildings, and I run a gallery called Millworks Gallery.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've had it almost 20 years.
Yeah, I've been wanting to...
18 years.
Put my slides and bring my work by.
You don't need slides. Nepotism counts for everything. Come see us. You can have a show. We've done 550 shows.
Oh, my gosh.
And we've been doing it 18 years, so... Mm. Yeah. You're only as good as your next show, and our next show opens next Saturday night.
Cool.
So, you know, it's what it is. Or a week from Saturday night. Okay, well, I got this thing.
Cool.
All right.
Well, we're a bunch of teachers, and we're part of this three-year grant through Cleveland State University to kind of integrate history into our curriculum.
And what do you teach?
I have...
Technical.
I have taught kindergarten first, fourth, and 4 years as a computer teacher, and I'm going back into the classroom to second grade.
Oh, good. They need help at that level. You know, because I mean, one of the big problems I read is these kids aren't getting taught at home, so they're going into schools woefully deficient of, you know, the primary foundation blocks to even launch kindergarten. So it's good you're going back young. Yeah, that's the whole. All right, so you guys are doing this, and we're taking an oral history of the redevelopment of the Cascade, Locks, Park, north end of downtown type thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's something I know a lot about.
Cool. Well, are you ready?
I'm ready.
We'll go start. Okay.
We're already on.
Action! Oh, we're already on. Okay.
Let's get some of the small talk. So yeah. I pushed the button a little bit before you were excited.
That's okay. I mumble, so tell me when I mumble.
Right now, we're receiving you quite well.
Good.
So just, we'll just start with a little bit of personal background. And, just tell us, where were you born?
I was born in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. My father was a paratrooper. And February 7th, 1954. They were stationed there, and my parents had finished college at Denison, and my mother was pregnant, and my father thought that's a guaranteed paycheck and benefits, and he was a corporal in the 101st Airborne. And so I was born there, and then came back to Cuyahoga Falls, where basically I've lived most of my life in and out of northeastern Ohio with some stops at undergraduate school in New York City. But basically I've lived in Northampton, Bath, Cuyahoga Falls, Silver Lake, downtown Akron, most of my life.
Wow. For the record, we need you to state your name.
My name is Michael David Owen. 286-46-1086.
You swear to tell the truth, nothing but the truth.
Why not?
So what did you major in?
I studied real estate and mass communications. I was fascinated by the power of the media. It was in 1976 that I graduated, and started in 72. You couldn't dislodge an American president that was a crook, and it was amazing to me that the media could unearth him. So I wanted to study that power. Hmm. But really all I ever focused on was real estate, and really all I ever focused on was old buildings.
Old buildings.
Old buildings. At that time, German Village was being redone, and some of the Victorian areas around that campus were being redone, and I just couldn't wait to go figure out how to get my hands on some old buildings and start fixing them up.
German Village in
Columbus.
In Columbus.
Yeah,
okay.
I went to Walsh High School here, and then I went to Ohio State, and then I went to University of Akron's Law School.
Wow. And when you were in high school, did you still have the same sort of interest?
Yeah, that's really what I was interested in doing. My father was in real estate, and he built buildings, and he built boring, profitable buildings, and I've resuscitated old, non-profitable buildings, but you know, I've had a blast doing it.
So your father kind of took you along to these projects?
Well, I think I realized by osmosis how much I had learned about real estate growing up, you know, but... When I got to undergraduate school and started a formal study of it, I realized that this had been a lot of dinner conversation, overhearing phone call conversations, driving around conversations, waiting to get a hamburger while my father finished a meeting conversations, and you know, a lot of it sunk in.
Hmm. I see that you brought this delightful journal, this everyday kind of visual journal. So when you were a kid, did you do a lot of drawings?
I was played a lot with crayons.
Uh-huh.
And I always doodled, and Last year, I wanted to learn how to draw. And so I took a drawing class, and a lady gave me some lessons in shading, some lessons in perspective. And I would sit there in the class, and they would say, well, let's draw this, and you got 40 minutes to draw it. Well, I would draw that and everything else in the room, and I would draw about 8 drawings to everybody else's one. And she finally told me, don't let anybody teach you. You just need to be released. So from that point, I've done a drawing a day, sometimes as many as 6 a day, and I fill book after book after book with my life.
Wow. And you didn't draw as much when you were a kid.
No. But, you know, the more outsider art I see, there's a real prolific outside artist up in Cleveland, a guy named Reverend Albert Wagner, who just passed away. Uh-huh. And I was just amazed at the volume of work. And so, you know, I don't know. I try to record my day in a sketch, in a quote, you know, whatever trips through my head. And
now, in your own perspective, could you define outsider art?
I'd say it's, you know, a way to look at things and record them aesthetically without the benefit of formal training. And so it's probably not as precise an undertaking, but it's quicker. Mm. And you know, I have the attention span of a gnat, so it works really well for me to draw in 3x5 pages because, you know, I can make a drawing as we're sitting here, you know. And
So when did you move here?
I moved back here after college. And the recession started in northeastern Ohio a lot earlier than it did on either coast. And when I came back in 76, it was really just starting to sink, and the manufacturing jobs were leaving. And a dormant economy with throwaway buildings and a shrinking population base is a window of opportunity for somebody that doesn't have any conventional capital and has the gumption to write land contracts to buy buildings, and that's what I started doing.
And so what brought you specifically here? Why did you come here?
I was the oldest of 4 children, and my family was here with 3 grandparents. And they waited till I was up to my ears in graduate school and owning my first house and launching a career, and they all left.
Huh.
And so I stayed.
Wow. So what area did you grow up in?
I grew up in Northampton.
So what's your current relationship or role in what you're doing in Akron?
Well, I do a form of urban recycling. I wouldn't say I'm a renovator because I don't cling to that painstaking detail. I take a lot of corporate America and economic America's discards and put them back to work. And I've always done it in a close relationship with the arts. I found that nexus between creative people and creative energies and revitalization to be a real strong connection. And I went to work for some people that did this nationally, and I traveled around the country doing it nationally, and I went to the business boot camp for a while and did this nationally with Goodrich, and really got tired of traveling and had the good fortune to work for the people that were redoing the old B.F. Goodrich factories, and was development director there, and we rehabbed about 1 million square feet of space there, and did that in some other cities in the country, and just, you know, saw a lot of revitalization take place. And then I got real lucky. I went into business for myself and got an opportunity to work as a consultant on a rehab project in Akron for the AES building. And now it's a 500,000 square foot building, and we got to do wonderful things there. And we finished that up. And by then, in this town, they had, you know, launched the ballpark and a lot of things that were going to spin off of the AES building. And so we went to the other end of town near Cascade Locks and started buying buildings. We bought 7 buildings in around Luigi's and really set out to try to build an arts district to enhance what Cascade Locks was doing and trying to bring literally the south end of the national park into the north end of downtown Akron. And the paradigm we were modeling ourselves after was in San Antonio, Texas, a place called Blue Star Arts Complex. And we've superseded that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little bit like building the mall. You get pennies, you throw a bunch of junk in around pennies. Mm-hmm. Luigi's was our penny store, and we basically threw in a blues bar, a wine bar, a bike shop, a hot glass studio, a for-profit gallery, two non-profit galleries, a lot of urban sculpture, and sort of spun an environment that, you know, I guess we got to the point where politicians wanted to take credit for it, so they brought you all the help you needed in the beginning, and we redid the streets, and then the yuppies got off the train, and now they're building towers with rock stars restaurants.
and specific rock stars?
Chrissy Hynde.
And what is she opening up?
She opened up a vegetarian restaurant.
And what's it called?
Vegetarian. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful job. You know, and I think when you're an entrepreneur, you want to have some legitimacy to your ideas. And when you have conventional capital follow your ideas, you know you had a pretty good idea. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to trigger probably in excess of $100 million of capital investment in that end of town. And it's grown far beyond, you know, what I imagined it would. We were able to partner with AMHA and get a 50-acre parcel down underneath the Y Bridge, and we've built 270 new homes down there. And it's a beautiful village. If you've not seen it, it's all modeled after Sears Craftsman design. And we've put new life in along the shores of the little Cuyahoga River down there, and really built a whole new neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's something for everybody. There's a place to live for everybody. And I guess, you know, it's, you want to have a place at the table for everybody. So it's good.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think that's important to this area?
Well, I think that on a couple fronts. I mean, you know, certainly our town can use an arts district. You've got a real good art program at Kent State. You've got a real good art program here at the university, and you've got a good graphics program growing at both places. And I think that, you know, that if you're going to try to attract a creative class to populate jobs that are opening in these entrepreneurial businesses, there's got to be a certain amount of lifestyle that somebody can affiliate with in coming back to what has traditionally been perceived as a Rust Belt city. And we kind of provide that environment. You know, we started it with this little gallery, and we've done this nonprofit gallery now for 18 years and 500 and some shows. And we thought down there, if we could marry a performing arts component to a visual arts component that we already had in place, that, you know, we'd really have something. And we've managed to now for almost 15 years play music six nights a week on the North Side stage. So that connection has really worked well. And then we started working on this ice house, which is an 1870 ice house, and putting lofts and studios in there, and living units and workspaces. And I met a kindred spirit up in Cleveland, a guy named David Shimo Takahara, and we started doing ballet in an abandoned industrial space. And this year we'll celebrate our 10th year of doing it, and that's where your friend Hal played. So, you know, it's important work in that it's a destination for people that want to do something that heretofore wasn't really in Akron. Because, I mean, you know, Akron's kind of a weird town. I tell people, you can do anything in Akron that you can do in New York. But if you wanted to go back out the next weekend, you'd have to go back to all the same places. Because we have everything. We only have one of them or two of them, but we have everything. And, you know, we didn't have that component, so we were able to bring that component and manifest itself in the north end of Akron. The other thing it does is that it gives a southern anchor to the park, because the park has not been able to reach through the environmental problems to really get to Cleveland. And Peninsula, you can't flush another toilet in Peninsula, you can't park another car in Peninsula, you can't set one more table in Peninsula. And when we started this project, I think people thought that Northside was really a downtown redevelopment project. Well, in your downtown, you're looking at like basically 20,000 people, and you kind of know what that'll do for you, and it's not enough to really sustain itself. What really the focus has always been is how do you work as a magnet for 2.4 million visitors that are coming to the national park that want to hike to a destination, bike to a destination, train to a destination, you know, they want somewhere to go. And we thought a lot of the public art and the galleries and the glass blowing and things like that would work, because one of the things we saw at Blue Stars, it wasn't just really a place to go shop for tchotchkes or walk through, you know, galleries. It was a place where you could see actual working artists working. And that's really what we tried to do, is provide an environment where you could come watch pottery being made, you could watch glass being blown, you could watch people paint, you could watch people sketch. Mm-hmm. And if we could do those kind of things, that would set us apart. And I think working with emerging contemporary artists in the 87 miles of the Canal Corridor, we're not just another tchotchke shop. I mean, nobody's going to come down there and find a basket being weaved. You know, you're probably going to find better luck finding metal sculpture.
And it was kind of like, was it your vision for it to be not a tchotchke thing and to be more of a original artist kind of?
Yeah, but you know me, you know, it's the collective we. You know, I mean, there's guys like, you know, Claudia and Michael, Claudia Zieber and Michael Martel and Stu Friedman and Jack Baker, who does glass, and, you know, George Roush, who paints. I mean, there's a whole host of people down there. And I think, yes, that focus has always been on emerging contemporary artists.
And what building in that area really kind of lights you up in terms of its architectural style? Or
the Ice House.
The Ice House?
Yeah, the Ice House is one of the coolest buildings I've ever done. I've had the good fortune to be involved in renovating probably in excess of 100 buildings, and the Ice House lights my fuse like nothing. Huh. It's got a beautiful land-to-building ratio. It has basically a secret garden of over an acre behind it, and the public art that's back there in the sculpture gardens is just beautiful. The spaces are dramatic. I mean, the Ice House itself is you know, close to 60 feet tall. You know, it's really a spectacular space. And it was really, it was a junkyard. It was a junkyard for 30 years before I got it. So, you know, the transition to workable art space from, you know, 400 wrecked motorcycles, 300 wrecked cars, stacked buses, you know, it's quite a transformation.
And did you see the potential in it as soon as you saw it?
As soon as I opened this garage door and saw a 60-foot high space that was 5,000 feet, yeah, that lit me up. But, you know, I have a real strange affliction. I mean, a lot of the buildings down in Northside, they're cute. My mother would like them. But I like rail sidings, tall fences, tall brick walls, multiple gate openings, and cobblestone. And it's got all those.
So what do you think were like the pinnacle, the watershed moments so far of this venture?
I think it really was, you know, it was a confluence of the work that was being done at Mustel Store with Virginia, the AMHA making a decision that they wanted to do something to eradicate the urban blight of the old projects. I think it was the Park Service feeding the infrastructure of the towpath, the trails, the parking lots, the train station. It was the city's recognition that, you know, we could pull this off, and if they would, you know, put some frosting on the cake was already pretty well built. It was really, you know, that coming together of a whole lot of different people's energies that you could turn around and, you know, nobody was really rolling the stone alone anymore. Hmm. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see where it goes next, because we're, you know, we're at a point where now we've created sort of this ground zero down at the corner of North and Howard Street. And the infrastructure is in all around it. There's housing, there's arts, there's entertainment, there's recreation, there's natural amenities, there's urban amenities. And, But right there at the crossroads is really where it needs to give life next, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next 60 months in that regard.
Now, have you thought about, or are you consciously infusing some of the history of that region into these projects?
I think it's all done with a regard for the history. So much of it revolves around the canals and the rails and the bridges and the old buildings. It's really a shame that there aren't five or six more old buildings down there, but urban removal took them all out. I don't know. I'm not a good one to ask because I'm real expeditious. You know, I want it done yesterday. I don't have a bit of patience. You know, a workable plan today is better than the perfect plan tomorrow. You know, so that's why I say, you know, I'm not really so much about historic renovation. I just move them along.
So tell me, what are some of the hurdles that you've had throughout this journey?
No money, environmental problems, egos. Pestilence, war, disease, you know.
What was that?
Pestilence, war, disease. I don't, you know, these are hard economic times. And, you know, when you're doing alternative projects with alternative properties, you know, banks don't really want to talk to you. Sometimes, you know, you're a real estate developer applying for, like, credit cards, you know, and you spend a lot for your capital. But, you know, if you got to have the capital or you got to do what it takes to stay alive, you smolder a credit card and factor it in. It's it hasn't been easy, but I think, you know, it gets easier now that I think the general public and the politicians can see it and see what it does. And it's been a vow of poverty, but it's been good missionary work, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, I mean, I see a lot of my friends that I went to law school with, and I think that, you know, they're 30 years in now, and they're chained to a mortgage and a lifestyle, and they need to keep doing it, and I don't really have those tethers, so I guess, you know, that's liberating. It's I guess, a lifestyle choice.
And you said mission. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's really something I think I take a lot of pride in, that we've been able to play music six nights a week for 15 years, that we've done, you know, 500 shows, that we've helped a lot of emerging artists, that we've given people a stage to play, that we've taken a shithole and made it nice and let people see what could be rather than what was. And I don't know, there's a certain degree of missionary work in that, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Now, what were some of the environmental constraints or hurdles that you had?
Well, anytime you're dealing with old buildings, you're dealing with, you know, lead paint, you're dealing with asbestos, you're dealing with, you know, PCB contamination, you're just running a gambit of environmental sensitivities. Because, you know, I mean, you can't turn around in a real estate deal for a 100-year-old building and not run into environmentals. It's just a fact of life.
Yeah, a lot of developers would just knock it down and build something new. And that sounds like a big kind of risk.
Well, you lose your history. And, you know, I don't know. You know, my mother would have argued that, you know, my favorite medium was 100-year-old brick. And, you know, I do like masonry buildings. Mm-hmm. You know, so as I said, they've always been sort of windows of opportunity, you know, because, you know, I've bought 17 buildings, and I always tell the sellers, you know, look, if you have somebody else to sell it to, sell it to them, you know. And if not, we'll figure out a way to make a deal, you know. But, you know, I mean, so most of the things I've ever bought probably weren't real marketable, you know.
Um, criticisms have you had with this?
Well, I'm like a bull in a china shop. I piss people off all the time. I don't know. I'm kind of myopic in what I'm focusing on, and I move towards it. I'm not a lot of times diplomatically correct. I'm not even remotely politically sensitive. And I think there's a reason that most of my work has been south of Cedar Street, north of Perkins Street, because in the middle and just central business district, I mean, if you want to take a piss, you have to have a meeting. And you know, I operate from a philosophy that it's a lot easier to apologize than it is to ask for permission. And so I've just have sort of taken their rat holes and they've left me alone. And, you know, so I just sort of have found a way to do my own thing, but I've taken their rat holes and made them nice, and I've been doing it long enough that they sort of leave me alone. And
now, without any kind of, and I'm not asking you to perpetuate any gossip or anything, but can you describe one of these criticisms and one of these head-butting? Because we're really interested in kind of your personal journey and the transformation of this landscape.
I think, you know, in this town, you're either in the club or out of the club. Mm-hmm. I've never really thought about being in or out. It's just not, I'd really rather be left alone, and they have been real good about that, And I think that, we've had the good fortune of having municipal leadership that is almost fascist. But, I like fascism. It gets things done, God bless the day that, Don Plasqualic wanted to be mayor and stay mayor, because, he's done it his way. And, I have a lot of respect for that. It's an old town. There's a good old boy network here, and, God bless them. They get a lot done. And, you can't fault the result. I mean, they have, other than maybe, Springfield, Illinois, and Columbus, Indiana, and Grand Rapids, Michigan, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a Midwestern town in this size that has weathered the storm of the last 30 years any better than Akron, Ohio has. I mean, it's completely reinvented itself, and that doesn't happen by accident, and it doesn't happen without a continuity of strong leadership, and we've had that, You drive through outside of Columbus, any city in Ohio, and I'll put Akron against any city in Ohio. I mean, it's amazing what's been done here and sustained, and not at the expense of the neighborhoods and not at the expense of the social infrastructure. And, arguably 6 years ago, you would have said maybe at the expense of the schools, but I don't know that that's a unique Akron problem. But even there, you've had strong leadership step in and guide the schools into a place where, they're at least credible. And you don't have to look any farther than 30 miles north to see where it's not working. The real price that they're going to pay in Cleveland has been that they've done all this work and hedged their bets against future income stream that really doesn't service their general population. And Don's been real smart here in Akron. He hasn't done that. It hasn't really been at the expense of the neighborhoods. There's been capital reinvestment back into the neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods, are somewhat sustaining. And a lot of times in cities, they get so, engrossed in doing large central business district projects that really work primarily for the people in the suburbs, not the people living in the city. And he's not really done that here.
And that's what you feel is really unique about this city?
Yeah, it's about this city, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you consider your father a trailblazer?
No. My father, I love my father dearly. But, he was a residential real estate guy that built buildings, and he still builds buildings. And, we do it a lot differently. We do it a lot differently. He builds small industrial park buildings, and they're good. But I've built a few of them in my life, and they're very boring. They're very boring to build, and they're very boring to watch go up, and they're very boring to manage. But, you know, they make money, so God bless them. My buildings don't seem to make money.
So where does kind of double attitude kind of come from?
I don't know. Yeah, the Nixon presidency. I don't know. No, it was a Jesuit education. The Jesuit education early on, they taught you that if you could see things and you were willing to make the commitment and do the work, you could leave work that would make the world a better place. And I bit. I've ridden it all the way through.
So how has this area changed? Just to describe it, how has this changed since you've become involved with this?
It's beautiful. It used to be a ghetto. What was an even bigger hurdle than I would have expected was the public's perception of the Howard Street corridor and on a region. It's like saying the word Huff to somebody in Cleveland, mm-hmm. saying Howard Street to somebody that is from the greater Akron area. There's no way they wanted to come down off there.
And so what year was this when you...
This was 95 when I started.
Okay.
We've changed the visual, we've changed the programming, we've changed the perception. We've built an environment that now people actually come to live. And, it's gone even beyond the bounds of my imagination, and I have a wild imagination. I think if I had taken either of you out into the middle of Main Street down there in 1995 and said, oh yeah, and down in that valley is where we're going to build 280 new homes, and you'll be able to see them from the million-dollar penthouses above the Rockstars restaurants. Yeah, that would have happened. My father probably would have taken me and locked me away if I'd have told him that. So it's been quite a transformation. I watch trains pull in and busloads of school children, come and get on trains and go away. Families ride bicycles and, neurotic people in electronic cars drive to eat, $65 tofu sandwiches. And, it's just amazing to me.
So this vision has occurred. What do you imagine from here?
More lifestyle enhancement. I think you're really going to start seeing the trains and the bicycles. I think you're going to get more housing. The galleries will continue to flourish. Luigi's will continue to sell pizzas. I just think it's going to be the infrastructure is now all in place. So it'd be interesting to see how many people come visit and what, their reactions are. Because, I have an office on a third floor or sort of overlooking the neighborhood, and I can't tell you how often now, whether it's a Franklin County plate or a Cuyahoga County plate in nice car, circling, driving around, looking, people coming just to look where, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, nobody even bothers, the way we've got it sort of layered up and branded, whether they're coming to Northside the Bar or the Northside Lofts or the Northside Arts District or the Northside Art Walk, you're hard pressed to find somebody regionally that hasn't heard that name. And it was a name that we made up. Because in 1995, the Indians were playing the Seattle Mariners in the American League Championship Series, and the manager of the Mariners was a guy named Lou Piniella. And if you look carefully, the Northside logo is basically the Seattle Mariners logo.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks it's a historic old name, but it's really not.
Yeah, so you're a big Mariners fan?
No, I just like compass points. Well, we knew we wanted to put North into it somehow.
Uh-huh.
North End, North, so it became Northside with, Seattle Mariners logos.
But still, what do you foresee? Especially now, gas prices are soaring and
Well, people have to come back and live in the city. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's, you can't afford to live out, and nobody can afford to extend the sewers and water and infrastructure out to one more field to build one more taupe-sided cul-de-sac. So, you know, it's, I think, you know, the people are beginning to take a look at what does it take to live in the city, where the population centers are, where the activity is, where the jobs are. You know, you already see it with our, you know, our kids. I mean, you know, did you grow up around here?
Yeah, I grew up in Kent.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you ever think about going to Akron U?
Well, my father taught at Kent State, so.
Okay. But, you know, when I was growing up, I don't think anybody thought about going to Akron U, really. It was like by default. And today it's a beautiful college.
Yeah.
You know, today at, you know, if you go downtown Akron at 1:30 in the morning on a Saturday night, there's 3,000 people, you know. And who'd ever guess that whether they were college students or driving in from Rittman or driving in from Medina, that downtown Akron would be the place that somebody 19 to 26 would want to flock to. Because, you know, when I came back from college in 76, you know, we could have shot rifles on Main Street and probably not hurt anybody. It's amazing. Wow. It's amazing.
Mm. Now, I bet you have met a lot of interesting characters in this.
We have met a lot of very interesting people.
What's one of the most interesting characters you've kind of encountered?
The most interesting characters I've ever encountered.
Within this project.
In this project? You know, might be an entrepreneur that has the bike shop down there, a guy named Richard Sparhawk. He's a great character.
Hmm.
You know, you couldn't have called Central Casting and had him send a better picture of an entrepreneur. You know, nice guy, grew up in the area, married the doctor, wanted the bike shop. You know, every entrepreneur's dream is to, you know, marry a doctor, because, you know, she pats him on the hand and tells him to go be constructive every day. You know, certainly a lot of he has the bike shop down there. Certainly the artists. I've met some people that I think are heroes. Virginia Wino. You know, I mean, I have an immense amount of respect for somebody that does something because it's the right thing and it becomes her passion.
Mm-hmm. But then why would you consider her a hero?
Well, I think that, you know, she built part of her life on a dream that she saw that not many people saw crystallized, and was willing to throw her energy and her time and her capital at pushing that dream to fruition. And that Cascade Locks is an amazing thing. I mean, at a time when the Park Service and the federal government and the Metro Parks couldn't get out of their own way to get this thing started, you know, she was down there building trails and making calls and making relationships, and, you know, she's a human force. I mean, you know, it's, she's living proof that, you know, you can make a difference if you care enough and keep trying. And so I'd say, you know, she's one of the interesting characters. You know, there's a couple of artists that are dear friends of mine, a guy named Jack Baker, who brought the glass blowing studio down there, and another friend of mine, John Communell, his sculpture is all over the Akron landscape, downtown and in Northside. You know, they're people that, you know, get up every day interested in something and move to make something better. Both of them were a lot more Geppetto than they are Picasso. And that workman approach of doing it every day is what I think it takes to get these things done. Because, you know, I have an 18-year-old son, and I tell him all the time, you know, Nick, you know, with a decent work ethic, some initiative, and if you can imagine, get yourself, you know, shit showered and shaved and out the door by 8 o'clock, you're ahead of 75% of the world. And I think he's starting to see the wisdom of that and the fact that he's been doing it a number of years. And, you know, I think that's what characterizes a lot of the people in that Northside district, is there are people that have said yes to an alternative lifestyle. And once they made that decision, they knew that to make it work, especially in these times and in this town, they had to work like dogs. And there's people down there that just work like dogs, morning, noon, and night. Those people are in those studios, they're burning those candles, they're making whatever it takes to make, to push the thing forward. You know, and I tell people that the real joy, I think, is to be what we call Northside Irregulars. And the irregulars are there every day. Because, I mean, the regulars, you know, the Yahoos, they come, they have fun, they go back to their cubicle. And, you know, it's good that we provide an environment that they can do that. But if you have to go work every day, it's a really great place to get to come every day to be with other people that have made a decision like you to pursue an alternative lifestyle. And it's a good supporting environment to be in. I think there's an old Camus quote that, you know, the rebel from the second he says no begins to say yes and has to say yes every day to survive or something to that effect. And that's a collection of those kind of people down there.
That's beautiful. So on our journey for this grant, we've been talking personal landscape and a sense of place. And we're wondering, like, if you look back in your childhood and you look at your sense of place, if you could pick any place in that childhood place that was kind of sacred to you, what would that place be?
I'd probably be in the woods. Because I'm a ruminator, I like to think. Or in an environment of creativity. My mother was a floral designer, you know, so I spent a ton of time as the oldest kid just doing my shit in the middle of florist shops and greenhouses. Mm-hmm. And delivering flowers, you know, I watched stuff get made. So, you know, it was a lifetime early on of watching a pile of materials, albeit beautiful materials, transform themselves into something. Corsage, boutonniere, flower arrangement.
That's observed
by your
mom.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that those were pivotal places for me. In undergraduate school, you know, wandering around the streets of German Village looking at this going, oh, I could do this. Hmm. Being challenged by professors.
Did you build forts when you were a kid?
I'm building one right now. Yes, I did. I've built tree forts. I draw tree forts. I have a show of tree forts in the gallery right now. And I just recently moved out of downtown Akron. I was living in a loft for about 8 years, and I bought a house out along the Cuyahoga River. And I bought this house, and it was with my son and I lived together, and he was 16 at the time. And I went back and walked the banks, and I'd been looking for a place on the river for a while. I said, you know, this is it. And he said, don't you want to go in the house? And I said, Nick, the house is immaterial. I can make the house into whatever we want. I can't make the shoreline. And I've been building a house or a fort right now. I have a wonderful one under construction. And I was telling this to a group of friends, and one of them looked at me like I was nuts, and another friend of mine chimed in. He said, well, what really more important work could we have than building our camp? So, yes.
And well, in terms today, what would be your sacred place in this?
Well, there's a secret garden behind the ice house that I found this strange turn of events one five-day period where I read in Dwell magazine about people fixing up old trailers, and then I read 2 days later a piece that I found in a Architectural Digest just by happenstance of people fixing up old Airstreams. And on the fifth day, I found a 1957 Silver Dome humpback trailer. Mm-hmm. And I renovated it, and I have it behind the ice house. And that'd probably be one of my real sacred places.
That's where you go, where you want to ruminate?
Oh. Actually, ironically enough, I live out along the Cuyahoga River, and I come back to town to camp. But there's if you've ever seen the books out at Kent, between the business school and the art school, the brain and the books.
Brinsley Terrell's.
Yeah, Brinsley sentenced me to a project one time, and he brought me 300 of those books. So in my courtyard at my trailer, I have a rather large volume, and then I have a lot of volumes at my fort.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have a lot of books. I'm a big reader.
All you need is a big sandstone brain.
No. I don't know. I couldn't believe you brought 300 of these things. I wanted like 8 to put around a fire pit. And all of a sudden I had, you know, pallets of them.
So if you were in a circus, what role would you be? What role would you take?
What role would I take? This is interesting. I just read a book about circuses. And I read one about 2 years ago, and they're fascinating things. Personality type and experience, I'd probably tell you I'd end up being a ringleader. But I think if I had a preference, I'd like to be a sharpshooter.
A sharpshooter?
Huh?
Uh-huh. Why so?
I like target shooting. I think it'd be a really interesting skill to cultivate and amaze people with. You know, as you know, I'm going through a transition in life where, you know, I've spent too much time in the center, and I've really always wanted to be on the outside. But I do like seeing things done my way. You know, there's a line from an old John Mellencamp song. What is it? I do things my way and I pay a high price. You know, that's been the story of my life.
Now, kids have sandboxes, and the interesting thing about a sandbox is you've got these walls to kind of play in. It's supposedly the limitation of creativity. Are there any limitations that kind of get you excited and funnel that energy? Or is it breaking down?
It's breaking down. Mm-hmm. It's breaking down. I read a line the other night in my book where the guy said that I guess maybe I'm more used up than I thought I was. You know, and I'm 54 and I feel that I'm tired. I'm tired of the battles. I feel like I've accomplished enough, I've given enough, and I want to do less. I work very hard every day to be home, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock so I can build my fort. I don't know. It's my light aerobics, hatchets, and you know, moving trees, and moving rocks, and shooting BB guns, paddling my canoe. And, you know, it's just like a big summer camp.
Now, you said you have kids.
I do. I have a 18-year-old boy and a 14-year-old girl and a 13-year-old boy.
What's your family think about this?
Well, I think my family's really proud of what I've been able to accomplish. I mean, we've done some amazing things. And I don't think that any of them really expected me to walk a real conventional path. You know, I think I've always seen things differently. And I think that they know that probably not anybody. And it's, you know, it's utilizing skills that have probably been in our family for a long time. And that's, you know, it's a really superb ability to communicate with people and figure out what needs to be done to keep things moving. Because it's a lot about momentum and capitalizing on momentum and finding people and pulling it into the momentum. It's the Tom Sawyer School of Economic Development. You know, if you don't really care who's there helping you paint fence, you can get a whole lot of fence painted. Hmm. And I'd rather have some fence painted shoddily and still have fence painted than be concerned about how each board looks. You know, wow. So you know, I don't think that my family's really all that surprised.
What kind of strategy do you use to kind of create that momentum?
I think it's just, you know, it sort of builds on itself. You run into people. You know, it's, the joke is that north side nepotism counts for everything. You know, I mean, in all seriousness, you know, I met you and you're a nice guy. And if you want to have a show, we'll figure out a way to have a show. Or if a band, you meet somebody that has a band, or you meet somebody that wants to have an event or have a picnic or has a place that their cousin needs to put a business. It's just meeting people and talking to people, mm-hmm. and having the ability to, you know, put space into people's hands. Mm-hmm. You know. And the conundrum now is that we don't really have any more space, and I don't want to buy any more buildings. You know, I want less, not more, in my life, you know. I mean, somebody showed me a building recently, and I said, you know, it's great. I go, you know, you just need to find like a 32-year-old me. Huh. You go, well, you know, you can make all sorts of money. I said, yeah, but, I don't, making more money doesn't get me back to my fort quicker, you know. Uh-huh. I don't want more. I don't want to own more. I don't want to do more. I don't, mm-hmm. I'm not interested in it. And that slows the momentum, mm-hmm. you know, because, I mean, that's my big thing now is to try to figure out the end game. How do I get these things perpetuated? Like, I could sell my bar, but, you know, just, you know, having a sports bar in the middle of that world help now, you know. I mean, how do I sell my bar to somebody that I can say, all right, you're going to buy my bar, but I want you to keep music on it 5 nights a week or 7 nights a week? Because, you know, if we're not providing a forum for roots music, that doesn't help Jack across the street blow glass, mm-hmm. you know. How do you sort of take yourself out of the mix? And I don't know the answer to that. Well, you know, and, you know, the legacy, it's going to be whatever it is. But, you know, I mean, I graduated a kid from high school. I've got two other that live, my other two kids are moving to Florida. I mean, I'm virtually like an empty nester. I'm 54, single, and have my health, you know. A few years ago, I took a sabbatical after I finished the AES building, and I was just driving around in my Jeep, camping. And I realized, man, I'm not really a grandiose guy, and I don't spend a whole lot of money. I'm thinking, man, I could stay gone a long time. I'm willing to work, you know. So sometimes I think, well, you know, maybe I got a big journey in me. I mean, a couple of years. Because I always made the joke that if the bottom fell out of my life, I'd find my boat trailer at Marietta. Maybe go get lost on America's rivers or do something different. You know, I've done this for a long time. And I think, find a way over the next few years to see myself clear to doing something different. I don't know, something where I can read and draw and think and travel by boat.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any like huge personal epiphanies throughout this?
Well, you know, being the son of a realtor, I was raised on Norman Vincent Peale. So, I mean, you know, I grew up empowered. And that's what I want for my children. And I want my children to see, like my father showed me, that, you know, if you're willing to do the work, you can dream big and go, you know. And it's easier to accomplish big dreams than it is little dreams, because you can get more help.
Why so? Because you can get more help?
Yeah. What I read the other night, it was great. Reading a book about the Chicago World's Fair, fascinating book. Mm-hmm. But what did this guy write?
You got it in there in your journal, huh?
Oh, I put them all in here. Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood. Mm-hmm. And that's true. That's true. So, you know, I mean, the epiphanies, yeah, you know, I mean, you want your kids to do this. But then, you know, you want them also to find ways to find maybe a little more peace than what I found, because it's been a turbulent life. It's a lot of work. And, you know, it's not a good thing. You know, you pay a price for keeping things out of balance. Mm. You know, and like I think my son will live a very small life. I mean, I think he wants to be like a fireman and, you know, probably have, you know, 4.2 kids and coach baseball, and, you know, just lead a very, very small, content life. And, you know, my life was anything but that. My father's was anything but that. And I think that's sort of the yin and yang. Mm. You know, like, but, you know, I got to, you know, he's a very empowered individual. He's, you know, accomplished a lot in his 18 years. And, I got a daughter that she's just a force of nature, you know. So it'll be interesting to see what she does.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that, you know, they have those moments of epiphany. And the other thing is it's I used to describe them when I smoke cigarettes as, you know, Marlboro moments. I mean, you do these things. There's one moment, and where you look and you go, "Wow, it worked." And you smoke a cigarette, and you smile, and you drive away. You know, no, I don't smoke a cigarette, but you know, that's that one moment of intrinsic satisfaction that feeds you and fortifies you for the next challenge. It's not really, I mean, once you've had adulation and, you know, I mean, it's weird. I've won weird prizes and certificates and been written about in a book and just TV shows and weird shit. But, you know, it's that one moment where it's just you. Mm-hmm. And that's when you realize what you do it for. Mm-hmm.
And what moment was that for you?
Oh, they can be looking at a building. Sometimes now we have the art walks. I'll go up in my office and I'll take a sandwich, sketch, and just you know, I refer to it as watching the model work. You know, see where people will park, where they won't park, where they want to go into. You know, hear a saxophone wafting out of a building on a summer night. You know, watching, you know, neurotic Prius owners go get, you know, chickpeas. You know, watch, you know, people in golden blazoned Cadillacs, you know, waddle into Luigi's, you know. It's just, you know, it's just the dynamics of everything. You know, the train will pull in or the trolley will be going in. There's people over at the ice house for something else. And, you know, it's just, it's funny. You know, it's funny because you were there when there was nothing. You know.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, it's... Absolutely. You know, I'm sure it's the same thing for you. You know, when you're sitting there and you're watching the kid in a conundrum over a paper, you know, and he, you know, all of a sudden you look over and it's just a flurry of activity and he's got it in his head. And, you know, he brings it to you and it's disheveled and wet and green, and but he's got this smile where, you know, you touched that kid. And I'm sure that you have those moments. So it's this different thing for a different, you know, expenditure of energy.
And you were talking at the beginning about children and their deficit today. What would you describe that? Children?
Well, I don't think they get the foundation stones. I really don't. I mean, putting a kid in front of a TV is not like getting read to or talked to or, you know, playing catch. You know, you learn to count. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, there's this void of, you know, mental and physical activity that I think, you know, kids really miss today. You know, it's all instantaneous. I even see it in my kids. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's my 18-year-old. What'd you do today? Nothing. Oh, well, I know you didn't do nothing. So you lived virtual. You know. You know, it's all here. You know, and I'm just the opposite. I don't really know anything about the internet. I don't have an email. I'm a curmudgeon. A Luddite, my son told me the other day. A Luddite.
A Luddite, yeah.
A Luddite. You know, it's sad. And I think, you know, with that goes patience and curiosity. You know, it's all about immediate gratification. There's no delayed gratification because, you know, it's a Google search away, whatever you want, you know. And I think that's sad. So, you know, I don't know. It's, I don't know how it will all shake out. I'm glad I'm old. I wouldn't want to be my children's child. You know, I think it's a very confusing world as it sits right now, and I don't think it's going to get any less confusing.
Mm.
I mean, in the primary, my son's going to be able to vote in the general election. He couldn't vote in the primary. And I said to him, I go, you know, I feel bad that my generation has left you this mess. Who do you want for president? I will give you my vote. You know? Mm-hmm. And so I voted for Obama, because that's who he wanted. You know? Because, I mean, I don't know. I don't think we've done these kids a real favor, what we're leaving.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think you're leaving them something with what you've created? Are you doing them a service?
Yeah. No, they've watched. They've seen dumpsters show up and shitholes be uncovered and the whole process. And yeah, I know so. Because this house that we fixed up, I never fixed up a house. And my son was 16, and you know he's got skin in this game now. You know, and he knows what it takes. To do the job and see the job done and what the steps are. You know, he knows how to make something that wasn't there something that is really transformational. You know, I mean, and those are priceless lessons.
Yeah.
Those are priceless lessons, you know. You know, I don't know that he'll ever work in construction, but it doesn't matter whether it's construction or teaching or computers or, you know, it's all the same applying a focused discipline to a task with an end in sight in finishing the task. Mm-hmm. You know, so I know that it's hit home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I see that in him, you know.
Now, you know, there have been so many people throughout history, you know, like Thomas Edison and Pablo Picasso are just incredibly driven people, and many people have written books and stuff about what has created their drive. I mean, in your own words, what has perpetuated your drive? What who lit your fire? Was it an influential person or
who lit my fire? Probably my father. You know, I'm one of those stupid kids, you know, anything that goes good, I call my dad to tell him. I just like seeing things get made better, you know. I mean, you go back to the fort. You know, my whole fort is basically shit that I found. You know, so it's a constructive reuse of found objects elevated to a higher plane. And I think that, you know, whether it's the buildings, most of what I've done, like I said, are more characterized by urban recycling than they are by historic renovation, you know. Individuals that lit my fire. I think mostly, you know, it's when you watch other people do things, you think, well, I could do that. That guy's no smarter than me. You know, it's, you know, just taking the chances.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta take chances.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you can't, you know, if you jump off the end of the boat and try to go in the water and still hold on, all you do is smack your head against the side. You know, so I mean, you've got to be willing to let go. And that's scary. It's, you know, and I don't know. I've been doing it 20 years. It's scary now. I'm in a scary time right now. We're in a recession. I'm undercapitalized and I'm overleveraged. You know, so I mean, you know, and if I fail, is that going to define me? I don't think I'll let it define me. But you know, it's all scary because you know you don't know. I mean, I haven't had a job in almost 19 years.
Mm.
You know, I don't know what it would be like to know that I was going to get paid on Friday. It'd probably feel really good. It'd probably feel really good. Maybe that's what I'll do in my next life. I'm going to be an accountant. I always see these people, you know, because I would finish what I was doing and, you know, I was divorced and self-employed. So if I would drive the errands to see my kids, I could see my kids like 6 and 7 days a week. So from like 4 to 7, I mean, I was just driving to Copley for baseball, driving here for swimming, you know. Mm-hmm. I have like Uber athlete kids. And I'd always see these people coming home from their cubicle, you know, 5:20. And I think that's what I want in my next life. I want to be an accountant, man. I want to go to work at 8. I want to be done at 5. Mm-hmm. I want to wear dark socks and sandals on weekends and just, you know, just have somebody drop money into an account.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what I have in my future.
That's the next thing you're letting go. And
I want to, yeah.
Jumping into.
I want to, yeah. I just want a job.
Maybe you'll find somebody to employ you to build tree boards.
I'm unemployable. Mm-hmm. I have a bad attitude. That's what, you know. You want me to show up when? Dressed how? And I have to stay how long? And you want this done?
Well, you're quite an incredibly fascinating person.
I don't know about that.
A great honor to hear your story. Is there anything you wanted to ask, Ronnie?
It's been fascinating because I don't know what the right term is. The fact that Joe's an artist, I have a son who's probably could walk in your shoes a lot. You know, no set time that he goes anywhere, but manages, you're obviously managing your life.
Sometimes it's the rocks, but it's all right.
Yeah, so it's a journey. I think it's to me amazing me, or kind of humoring me that we've interviewed you. You know, it's, I don't know, that the story about karma or something. But you've made a difference.
I have. My life has made a difference. And right. That is probably the biggest reward. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest reward.
And I was thinking as you were sitting there, you sit in your office and you can look and see what you've done. There aren't a lot of people that can do that.
I know. It's a choice. I feel really blessed. I feel really blessed, you know. And mm-hmm. and I've done it, you know, with wonderful people sharing great common experiences, and together what we've accomplished. Because I mean, I can't do anything. I went to a Jesuit high school. All I can do is dial a damn phone. I mean, I can't.
I don't think your people there would like to hear you saying that, but that's okay.
No, well, you know, I mean, but really, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not a carpenter. I'm not a glazer. I'm not an architect. You know.
Mm-hmm. But you've made a difference, and you know, I was like, okay, how did that happen? I'm sure you can't. Well, I shouldn't say I can't speak for you, but it just happened. The kind of thing. So your advice to other people?
Dream big. Work hard.
What was that again?
Dream big. Work hard.
Dream big.
Work hard. Work hard. Mm-hmm. You got to get up and go every day. You know, mm-hmm. you got to get up and go every day. And, you know, so if you're going to go do that, do something that interests you. Because, I mean, you know, I mean, yeah, it's a drag sometimes, and it's hard, and it's fraught with uncertainty, but it's fun. You know, I mean, I've gotten to live my life. I tell people, you know, if I died tomorrow, you know, you stand there and go, you know, that guy lived. Mm-hmm. He lived. He lived mm-hmm. hard. You know, it's meeting people like Hal. I mean, you know, when I watched Hal do those percussion instruments.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, that was, and it was in a theater we created in an alternative space.
That's Hal Walker.
Yeah, right.
To know, yeah.
Right. But, you know, the day I closed on that building, I dragged Jen Maurer in a guitar case up there and said, play. I just want to hear music in this space.
Yeah, the acoustics in there are just
right.
beautiful.
So then, you know, to think that, you know, 9 years later we could transform it even for a night into a magical 200-seat theater and you could bring somebody like Hal to entertain people. That path to that moment is what you do it for. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a painting or a musical performance or some saving a building or watching some people, you know, have fun in your building. I don't know. It's these little moments, and they're what feed you. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, when I'm destitute and old, I may find yourself on your, you know, floors, and you feed me. You
know. Was there anything you'd like to add? Or?
No, but, you know, what is this? Rivers, Roads. Cool. Can I get a copy of the...
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
Now, how will this all come together? Well, can I get something at the end that would, where I could hear the stories?
Yeah, this is going to go in an archive, probably at Cleveland State University, and it will be for historians to kind of research and look at. It's not going to go on YouTube as or anything of that nature, but it's going to be a record for people that want to see. How different projects have been formed in terms of the river, rails, and roads in this region, the canalways,
cool.
The railroads, and the actual highways and byways that have cut up and divided and changed neighborhoods and whatnot. So we've dealt with like the West Creek Project in Parma. What are some other
aspects that we're dealing with, what Canal Park.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, I would like to have it. I've been really lucky, you know, and there's been some pretty interesting magazine articles that were written by, like, Inc. magazine, and then, you know, some guy wrote a book. Some guy wrote a book called From the Ground Up. It's a Harvard Library book about the seeds of American entrepreneurs. And then I've been on a couple of PBS shows, and they really record well things that I would like to be able to give my children someday. You know, I mean, here's what, you know, I mean, very few people get that, you know, where I could go, here, here's an hour PBS show that, you know, is basically an interview of your dad at, must have been 40, 41 at that time. And then here's now a interview with your father at 54. I would love to have these things of my father and grandfather. Yeah. So, you know, if, you know, when you're done, if I could, you could get that would be really a cool thing to be able to, I don't know, time capsule, for lack of a better term, but, you know, that my kids could, because, you know, I do have the benefit of, my kids can go see my buildings, you know, I mean, whether they own them, whether they're not, you know, I think I'm just stewards of them, you know, but I generally take something that's 100 years old and give it at least another 100 years of life. You know, who owns it's kind of immaterial. Mm-hmm. But these would be great things to be able to leave my kids.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, if you can help me in that regard, that'd be good.
Yeah, most of it. You can get a copy of the CD.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you have an extra copy of the release here?
Sure.
So I can...
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Most people you talk to are pretty interesting, I imagine they are.
Yeah.
Who else you talk to?
We talked to this morning.
Well, there's a whole list.
We're going to be talking to Elaine Marsh. And
CD of this interview.
Yeah.
In within a week or two. you will get
it. Oh, John Debo. You know, he's a great guy.
And, again, the whole project behind this, you know, idea is there's more to...
Oh, Jen Maurer's great, too.
Various projects, you know, it's not one person, it's not one thing, it's not just the park, it's the people around the park. And, you know, you being, you know, the community around the park was one of the reasons too. You know, you are an important role to why the park is going on, and, you know, et cetera.
It was really nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
You have intrigued me too. I can't say that I've been to the north side, and I need to get there.
Oh, yeah, well, come. The first Saturday night of every month, we do art walks.
Okay.
Get down there, and everything's open, and you'll be real amused. You watch people blow glass.
First Saturday of every month.
First Saturday of every month.
Okay.
And, well,
you can go down there. The ice house is open. You can be real amused. Go back there and see the trailer. Last year they did this Metro Living Tour.
Okay.
And they took, you know, all the happy havens, and the trailer was the big hit.
Yeah. I'm going to say, I can envision, I mean, I'm open-minded, but boy, my son's going to love this.
Oh, yeah.
He's home from New York right now.
Oh,
he's
nice.
He's an aspiring artist, actor.
You can have a show at Northside, too.
I've played at your place many times.
Oh, yeah?
At a jazz fusion group called Osmosis.
Oh, yeah. I know that band. Yeah. We had your CD release party.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Big heavy set bass player?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that band.
We all went in different directions. The sax player went to get his doctorate in music, and I was getting into Eastern music. I started going the route of playing tabla drums from North India, and Sam, he was getting more into kind of devotional, kind of Christian devotional, and we just kind of, because we were together for like 6-7 years.
Yeah, that's a good band.
I'm going to have your sheet. Oh, nice. Is he taking the release for me? Yeah, I'm taking it out of the blank. Okay, because we need one that he's trying to explain to my girlfriend what this thing was. Uh-huh. Go ahead. Yeah, she's asking more questions. Well, it's going to be archived in Cleveland Memories. I don't know if you're familiar with Ohio Memories, but you can go online and listen to all sorts of things, and this will be archived. You know, we've been told it's going to be a year or two before it actually is in the archives.
Well, you guys are real disarming. You felt really comfortable sort of telling you my story.
So good.
We want to make it comfortable.
Thank you.
Cool. You know, yeah, I've never been on Make Jazz Work. We have a jazz workshop right now that is as close as I've ever been on to Make It Come. But you know, jazz in Akron just doesn't work. We'd be a jazz club if it worked. I love jazz.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
You know, I can't get enough people to come here.
Yeah, you've had some great groups in there.
You've got a good one. And I've been really trying to get rid of the bar. I'm trying to get rid of the bar.
The bar
was a necessary evil to make the neighborhood work because you need a catalyst.
Right.
I've never had an operating business. I've never had an employee. I've never walked in and sat down and ordered a beer in my life and don't drink. I can't believe I'm on the bar for 15 years. Now I don't know what to do with it because it's not just another corner bar. You know, I've got this bar that potentially could be a regional icon.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but I
am so like tired, done dealing with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I mean, I got like 85% of life things in this stupid bar. But it's a good bar.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do.
Well,
thanks for talking.
It was nice meeting you. I'll be contacting you.